Lecture 46, Cleopatra's Family.
Welcome back. Last time we talked about animal mummies, one of those sort of preoccupations of the Ptolemies. What I'd like to do is return to our Ptolemies. And if you'll remember, when Ptolemy XI died, they had sort of killed themselves off, right? These horrible Ptolemies. They had killed themselves off, and there was no legitimate heir. No legitimate heir. And the one who winds up on the throne is the man we call Ptolemy XII, right? Now, he is called by himself Neos Dionysius. That's what he calls himself. He's the new Dionysius. It is a kind of, he's saying, you know, that's my god now. That's my patron deity. This is not what the people of Alexandria called him. Right? He had two nicknames. Now, first, he was illegitimate, so he is called the bastard by the people of Alexandria. He is also called Oletus, which means the flute player. And it's really derogatory. The idea was that he did indeed play the flute. He's sort of like the Greek equivalent of Nero, you know, and his fiddle. He played the flute and didn't really govern the country. So they called him a flute player. You'll see a lot of sort of comparisons, by the way, with the Ptolemies and the Romans. You know, for example, it starts to sound a little bit like I, Claudius, you know, everybody killing everyone. There are a lot of similarities. But anyway, Ptolemy XII is on the throne, this sort of illegitimate child who plays the flute. Now, let's think about the times. Greece is no longer the only superpower in town. There is an even stronger power at this time, Rome. The Greeks, it's a very interesting situation between Greece and Rome. The Greeks view the Romans as uncultured, uncouth, and there's some reason for this. Rome is a superpower, and the reason it's a superpower is it has an army. I mean, go back to our ancient Egyptian civilization when the pharaohs like Thutmose III, Ramses the Great, rode out with the army. They had a disciplined, standing army. That's why Rome is a superpower. They are disciplined. If you remember, I mentioned it once, that we get the word decimate from the Roman army. When their commanders thought that the men hadn't fought bravely, that they had been cowardly, 1 in 10 was taken and executed. So 1 in 10 became decimated. Right? These Roman soldiers were disciplined professionals. That's why Rome is a power. Now, it's a military power, which gives it economic clout. But that's different from saying that it's cultured. See, we tend to think of Rome as a seat of culture. It wasn't always like that. It wasn't. Compared to Alexandria, Rome was a small city of mud houses, mud brick houses. They didn't live in palaces made of alabaster and marble. No. They hadn't learned yet how to be great. And as a matter of fact, you know, when you see Rome today, that's Rome of a little bit later period. These are not yet, you know, Romans aren't yet really cultured. Now, the Greeks looked down on the Romans, even though the Romans are the superpower. But this was a problem for the later Ptolemies and for our Ptolemy XII. It's a problem. They had to pander. The Ptolemies had to pander to the Romans. Remember we had Physicon, Fatty, being run off, right? And you have others being murdered. Well, the Ptolemies, to stay on the throne so the people wouldn't attack them, paid the Romans. Because the Romans had the army. So the idea was, you gave money to Rome, they would keep you on the throne. Now, why would they keep you on the throne? Rome wanted the constant wheat flowing into Rome. They needed Egypt's wheat to feed Rome. And there's a phrase that's used in the history books all the time, and it's accurate. Egypt became the breadbasket of Rome. So the Romans had this interest in Egypt. They wanted to keep a strong ruler on the throne, so they could do business with him, so they could get the grain. The Ptolemies were weak at the end, so they paid Rome to keep them on the throne. It was a kind of mutual symbiotic thing. But think about what Alexandria was now. Place of culture, learning, right? Ptolemy I and II had built the library. We have this beacon, the Pharos lighthouse, shining out. The kings live in marble palaces in splendor. And the Greeks love this. They love it, 300,000 Greeks. But they're not the only ones in Alexandria. Alexandria is really divided into three segments. There are Jews, a large collection of Jews who are the merchants doing business in Alexandria. And there's another section, the Egyptian section. You know, we call it a quarter, but it's thirds. It's the Egyptian section. Now, the Greeks, these cultured, viewing themselves as top of the world, but no longer do they have an army that can really do stuff. And you've got their ruler, a Ptolemy something, Ptolemy 10, Ptolemy 9. And that ruler is pandering to these boorish Romans. So the Greeks who are living in Alexandria despise the later Ptolemies. They despise them. And for the Ptolemies to stay on, they have to deal with the Romans. So it's a terrible, vicious cycle. And it's going to cause real problems, real problems. We know a little bit about Ptolemy XII's early reign. We have a stela, those great sources of information, those carved stones that endure. And one of the things we know is that he took a kind of family trip to Memphis. To Memphis, the old capital, right? You know, one Ptolemy who finally got out of Alexandria and did something, went to Memphis, taking his children with him. And he's got children, right? He's got plenty of children. He's got Berenike, oldest girl. There's another girl, Cleopatra. She's Cleopatra VI. There's another daughter who's another Cleopatra. That's Cleopatra VII. That's our Cleopatra. That's Elizabeth Taylor. That's the one who becomes the famous Cleopatra. And there are two half-brothers, two Ptolemies. And Cleopatra has a younger sister, Arsinoe. So it's a busy household, busy household. The palace is full. And on this stela, we hear that Ptolemy XII Dionysius took the family to Memphis. And it says on the stela, and this is important, it says, and we saw both sides of the river. In other words, they're looking at everything, right? They're not just looking at one side, they're looking at the other. Now, what could they have seen? Right? Think back. What do you think would have been the main attraction around Memphis if you're going on a sort of royal tour? I mean, imagine the Clintons going on a tour of some place. What would they have been shown? Well, one place for sure is they would have been shown the Serapeum, the burial place of the sacred Apis bull. Right? They would have been shown that. Now, let's think about our Cleopatra, because she's going to be the one who features important, you know, very important in the future. This is the time, she's a kid, not even a teenager yet at this time probably. And she's taken into this subterranean chamber where probably the whole family is together looking, and they can't read the inscriptions. They spoke Greek. And some priest is guiding them, telling them what it is. And she's hearing Egyptian also spoken in the background. And she sees these sarcophagi of the Apis bulls, and there's incense undoubtedly. And it's in a darkened tunnel. Must have been an incredible impression. Incredible. Now, this young girl is going to grow up to be the only Ptolemy to speak Egyptian. You know, and it may be just this kind of impression that what urges her, pushes her on to learn this language of the Egyptians. And even maybe she becomes infatuated with the religion itself. So we know that this flute player, the bastard, took his family to Memphis, where they saw various sites. Undoubtedly, the Serapeum. Now, Rome, the superpower, is a republic. Right? They don't have kings. Rome doesn't have kings now. They are ruled by a senate, a large senate. It's a representative government, at least in principle. But now we get a new invention of the Roman government, the triumvirate. The Roman government invents the triumvirate. It's a panel of three men who are really ruling Rome, right? Crassus, Pompey, and Caesar. So we've got three men ruling Rome. Ptolemy the 12th makes a deal. He wants to make a deal. He wants to make sure he stays on the throne. And he knows he's weak. So he tells them, basically, the triumvirate, right? He deals with Pompey, Caesar, whoever's there. And he says, you keep me on the throne, I will pay you. And a deal is cut eventually. The deal is something like this. He will give them virtually the entire income of Egypt for a year. Tremendous amount to keep him on the throne. Now, when he goes back, right? Remember, the Greeks hate the Romans, don't like their ruler pandering to Rome. He's got to raise taxes. He's got to pay the debt. So he raises taxes, thereby infuriating the Greeks. Right? So much so that he is run out of town. They run him out of town. And where does he run? Naturally, to Rome. Who becomes the ruler? We've got the children back in the palace, remember? We've got a young Cleopatra. We've got an older Cleopatra. We've got Bernice. We've got Arsinoe. We've got two young boys, half-brothers. The one who takes the power is Bernice, the oldest sister. The oldest of the sisters. She seizes the throne. Now, a woman seizing the throne, it couldn't have happened in Greece. In a sense, and let me get ahead of my story, Cleopatra, the great Cleopatra, Cleopatra VII, couldn't have been Cleopatra in Greece. If you think about it, you know, we don't know the names of very many Greek queens, but we sure know Egyptian queens. Remember, starting with the 18th dynasty, women start to become powerful. Right? We don't hear about women much in the Middle Kingdom, the Old Kingdom. But in the 18th dynasty, we get somebody like Hatshepsut becoming king. We get Queen Tai influencing her son. We get powerful women. This is an Egyptian phenomenon. Egyptian. And remember, perhaps the most powerful of all of the gods, in a sense, is Isis. She's the one who interacts and has the power, and she's the goddess of magic. So, when a Greek woman seizes the throne in Egypt, there is a precedent. We've got strong women, and that's something that you will see in the future. Bernice takes the throne. Now, what I wonder about, and I'm always thinking about Cleopatra VII, my Cleopatra, because she's the really interesting one, as you'll see. What is she thinking at this point? She's living in the palace with two older sisters. Bernice has seized the throne. Got two younger brothers there too. Got a younger sister, Arsinoe. What's she thinking? Well, one of the things I think she's thinking is, am I going to stay alive? Because we know that the Ptolemies have this horrible history of killing their brothers, sisters, mothers, everybody. And she, in a sense, is a threat to the throne just because she's royal. And just because she's alive. Bernice is on the throne, but she doesn't have a husband. And the Ptolemies required that they come in pairs. It was a tradition. Usually you married your sister. She needs a husband. It's required. She marries a cousin, right? He's boorish. Marries him, though, and has him strangled the next week. Right? It doesn't last long. But Bernice's pretty strong. I mean, she's something to be reckoned with. Anyway, she finds a husband, a friend of hers, literally a friend, and marries him. And now we have a royal couple. So now there's Berenike ruling with her friend as her husband. What's going to happen? Cleopatra at this time, teenager. What was her life like? Right? She's worried, of course. But also remember, she's growing up in luxury. She's living in a palace, probably the greatest building on earth right now. And you know what she had access to? The library at Alexandria. The library. So as a child, undoubtedly, she goes to the library, and she's interacting with scholars. We know, I mean, there's a tradition, shouldn't say we know, but there's a tradition that sometimes she was at the side of her father, Oletus the flute player, when he greeted ambassadors, and that she would see what was going around at the palace, and she would sometimes be allowed perhaps to greet them in their own language. She was learning languages as a child. So she goes to the library. Now, what can she read in the library? What's there? Well, one of the things that I always think about, we do not know exactly what she read. We have no record whatsoever of any specific work that she read as a child. But I would bet anything she read Herodotus. Our Herodotus, who was there around 450 BC, a Greek who wrote in Greek. And she read Herodotus, and she read the history of Egypt. And she knew that this was a great history. This was going to influence her, because she was going to become, in a sense, an Egyptian again. But we've got her sister on the throne. Sister's on the throne. Pompey's one, Crassus the second, and Caesar's the third. And he's going to bribe anybody he can talk to keep on the throne. What does Ptolemy the 12th say? He says, I'll give you money. You're going to keep me on the throne, but you're not going to get paid unless I stay on the throne. So it's a kind of logic that works. Rome isn't going to get this great bakshish, as we say in the Middle East, unless they keep him on the throne. And they're going to keep him on the throne. So they send troops back to Alexandria. And you know who goes with those troops? Mark Antony, head of the cavalry. And there's a battle. Berenike on the throne has picked a strong husband. He marches out to fight the forces of Rome and is killed. He's killed. And one of the signs that Antony is a good man is that Oletus, the flute player, who is now back in Egypt and on the throne, wants to let the body rot on the battlefield. Let it rot. That's what he tells him. Now, this is the worst thing that a Greek can do to a Greek. The worst. It was always a point of honor, if you could, to bring back the body. I mean, there was even a great Spartan saying, you know, you said to Greek soldiers when they went out, come back with your shield or on it. Right? Not only being brave, but you're going to come back and your fellow army men were going to carry you on your shield. Right? So he's willing to let the body rot. But Antony won't permit this. This is a noble man. He's an army man. And he understands such things. So, the body is buried. And the Egyptians recognize this as a good man. So, Oletus, our flute player, is back on the throne. Now, who was happy and who was unhappy about this? It's interesting to speculate. Well, certainly unhappy is Berenike. Right? He has her executed. His daughter, who seized the throne, is viewed as a traitor. The husband's out of the way now. And I think one of the people who must have been happy was Cleopatra. Cleopatra VII, our Cleopatra. What about Cleopatra's sister? Remember she had an older sister named Cleopatra? Well, I ask you the question, I don't really have an answer. She disappears right at the time of Berenike becoming queen. The general assumption is Berenike had her killed. So now we've just got Cleopatra in the palace with her younger sister Arsinoe and the two boys, two Ptolemies, those half-brothers. Oletus is back on the throne. Right? The Greek population of Alexandria can't be too happy about this, but they can't do anything about it either. There are a couple of interesting consequences of this action. One is, we now have Roman troops stationed in Alexandria. Roman troops. And you know, they're pretty happy about it. This is pretty good lodgings. You know, they've got good food. They've never seen a city like this. Alexandria is the greatest city in the world. And there are ships coming. There's things going on. So they're pretty happy to stay put. They don't want to get out in the grubby warfield and fight. No, they don't want that. That's one consequence. Roman troops in Alexandria. Aulenius uses them carefully. He's no longer the flute player. I think he knows his days are numbered. And he becomes a serious ruler. He's fighting to stay alive. That's what he's doing. Fighting to stay alive. So he keeps an eye on the troops. Keeps them under his thumb. The other thing Aulenius does, Ptolemy 12, he starts building. Building temples. Right? I think he's feeling, this may be my last hurrah. And he builds on an interesting site. Philae Island. Philae Island. Now, Philae Island, if you'll remember, is an island near Aswan, the southern border of Egypt. And if you'll go back just a few lectures.
One of the last native rulers of Egypt, Necdenabo I, right? Remember Necdenabo I?
Built a kiosk on Philae Island. This is where the Ptolemies chose to build, on Philae Island. I think there's one reason is it's an available piece of land. There wasn't a lot of temples there, right? Wasn't a lot of temples. But also, you know, Greeks always liked water, and this is an island. It's not an Egyptian kind of mentality that builds on an island. It's a Greek mentality, and these are Greeks. And in a sense, Philae is the Karnak Temple of the Ptolemies. In other words, remember how at Karnak Temple in Thebes, one pharaoh after another added a temple, added a temple, added a temple? This is their Karnak Temple. One Ptolemy after the other builds on Philae. Now, there's several unusual things about Philae. One that always strikes me, you know, it is, many people say, it is the most beautiful temple in Egypt. Many people feel that. And it's not just the setting. It's really exquisite. And one thing it shows is that bad people can do good things. You know, it's a beautiful temple. Another amazing thing about it is that it works. What I mean is, when you visit Philae Temple, it just seems like a beautiful temple. But it was built piecemeal. One guy adding something, one guy adding something. It's surprising, but it works. It's dedicated primarily to the goddess Isis. And Isis during the Ptolemaic time, during these Ptolemies, is rising. Her stock is going up. She is by far the most important goddess in Egypt now. She is considered the wife of Serapis. Remember Serapis, the manufactured god of the Ptolemies? The one who looks like Zeus with a basket of produce on his head? She is the wife. And Serapis is less important than Isis. We hear more about Isis because she interacts with the daily people. She is the goddess to whom you prayed if you wanted something. She is the nurturer. So these Ptolemies are building temples on Philae. And Aulenius, Ptolemy 12, his swan song, he builds on Philae, dedicating to Isis. Philae, by the way, is one of the temples, which was moved when the Aswan Dam was built. Now, remember that the Nile flows from south to north. And when the dam was built at Aswan, the water behind it backed up, forming Lake Nasser, the largest man-made body in the world. Right? This is the 1960s it was begun. And what that meant was temples were going to be flooded, submerged forever as the waters back up, submerged forever beneath the waters of Lake Nasser. UNESCO started a major, major project to save the monuments of Nubia, as it was called. And what various countries did was they each almost adopted a temple. And different engineers came with different plans to move temples. For example, if you'll remember from Ramses the Great, I mentioned briefly that Abu Simbel was moved. Ramses' great temple was cut in blocks and moved to a harder, higher part of the island, right, of the mainland, higher. Philae, the entire island, had to be moved. Every temple on that island had to be moved to a different island. Now, think about how you're going to do that. The waters of the Nile, by the way, when they come to the conclusion they've got to move the whole temple, are rising. They only had a few years before this thing was going to go under forever. Forever. There were plans, by the way, not to move this Ptolemaic complex. But what they were thinking of doing is building a cofferdam, sinking pilings right into the Nile, all around it, so it would be protected from the rising waters. That was rejected. Eventually, a cofferdam had to be built just to save it while they were moving it. But it was finally decided that they would move Philae Temple to a nearby island, higher up. It was a higher island, and the entire temple was dismantled. Blocks were numbered. And this, by the way, was a wonderful chance for archaeologists. For the first time in history, we could see all six sides of a block. And you might say, well, what do you learn by looking at the underside of a block? The answer is, you see the workman's marks. You see quarry marks. You see arrows saying this way. You learn how it's tied together. You learn that there were mistakes. Not only that, you learn that some of these blocks were reused. Some Ptolemies took them from previous temples, took the carved side, put it down, and then carved their inscription on the uncarved side. So it was a boon to archaeologists to be able to move an entire temple. And for we in America, by the way, if you want to see a temple, a Nubian temple, one that was south of the Aswan Dam, go to the Metropolitan Museum of Art in New York. There is a small temple called the Temple of Dendur. It's not Dendera. People often confuse it. Dendur is a much smaller temple of a late period, even after Ptolemy, just after. It's the Roman period. But this was given to the United States because of our effort in saving the other Nubian monuments. So Philae is totally dismantled and reassembled on a higher island. This is one thing, just one thing, that Ptolemy XII is doing in the last years of his reign. Another thing that he's doing is planning for his death. He's in his 50s, early 50s, right? But he's not going to last very long. And I think he knows it. And he leaves a will for the administration of Egypt. He places the will in two spots, two cities, Alexandria, where he's king, and Rome. He is so indebted to Rome that he has to make sure that they will approve of his choice of successor, that they will approve of what will happen after his death. This, I think, by the way, is one of the reasons why the Romans were so willing to march with Mark Antony to Alexandria and put him back on the throne. Berenike picked a husband without asking Rome. Right? She was going to do it on her own. She's a Greek. These Romans are upstarts. But Ptolemy XII, he wants to make sure that the succession will continue, and he okays it with Rome. And what does the will say? It says that there's supposed to be two rulers. Two rulers. Now remember, you had to have a husband and a wife. And the Ptolemaic tradition was, it's a brother and sister, like Isis and Osiris. And in Ptolemy's will, he says, the female ruler should be my eldest daughter. Now it's the oldest daughter who's left. Remember, Berenike, he's killed. Cleopatra VI has been killed by Berenike to get her out of the way. The oldest of the two daughters, the older of the two daughters, is Cleopatra VII, our Cleopatra. And she is to rule with her younger brother, who will become Ptolemy XIII, on the throne with her. This is Ptolemy's will, and this is what's going to happen. And next time we will see what happens to Egypt when Cleopatra finally sits on the throne.